Alois said I needed to talk about something having to do with analytic philosophy, which I'm glad to do. And at the bottom of the handout, I wanted to establish my credentials by making sure you knew that I knew some logic. It's not actually as complicated as it looks there, and it won't take me too much to explain that. But anyway, I do have a handout here just because some of the things that I'll talk about are a little hard to keep track of, and so it'd be helpful if it's written down. And I didn't want to have to write it all on the board, though I do have some things to write on the board. And this talk today, I think maybe there's just a tiniest bit about Wittgenstein, but it's really not about Wittgenstein. In fact, this talk reaches back to research that I was doing for my dissertation, and when I was first teaching as a professor, I pretty much worked squarely within analytic philosophy on these kind of issues, and then kind of changed my focus for a while to Wittgenstein, but certain issues started to look different to me from the perspective of having studied Wittgenstein more carefully. And so this is an example of how I went back to an issue that I had been interested in once before with a little bit of different perspective on that issue and decided to write something up about it. So let me start by giving a kind of introduction to the problem, because I don't know if you're even familiar with this term supervenience. I can't say, but I want to say some things about why one might be interested in supervenience, and then I want to talk about a particular issue within that subject and how I want to look at that. Anyway, anyone who studied philosophy at all is familiar with René Descartes, the French philosopher, who had the view that the soul and the body were two different substances. And by soul, I take him to mean more or less what we mean by the mind. At least I'm going to use those two terms interchangeably. And my interest here isn't so much to be a scholar of Descartes, but just to pick up on some ideas that we're familiar with to motivate what I want to talk about today. So Descartes is famous for what you might call his theory of dualism about the nature of the mind and the body, that there are two things there. There's the mind and there's the body, and that these can operate more or less independently of one another. This is especially important for Descartes insofar as the soul can outlive the body. That is to say, when the body dies, the soul can go on doing whatever it is doing without the assistance of the body. But it seems to be an implication of this that also the soul could operate independently of the body, even in this life here. And so Descartes' position about the relationship between the mind and the body, we'll call dualism, and although you might say that people often find it fairly natural, especially religiously motivated people might find it fairly natural to think that the soul is quite a different thing and disconnected from the body, when you start to think about the issue philosophically, there starts to be problems about that as to how the soul could be completely disconnected from or independent of the body, and what the how they could communicate with one another, and how one could have any kind of effect on the other, because there does seem to be an effect from our body to our soul. For example, if I were to stomp on Simo's foot here, that would be a physical thing, but presumably it would have some mental effect too of pain. And if he did experience this mental experience of pain, then he might be inclined to, I don't know, punch me in the nose or something like that. That would be a physical movement. So there does seem to be a kind of interaction between the mind and the body, but if they're two totally different things, then there's a question of how that could be. Well, philosophers who are impressed by that problem then have sometimes gone to the other extreme and offered a theory that we call the identity theory, that the mind really is nothing other than the brain or a physical kind of thing. So far from being independent of one another, according to this other point of view, called the identity theory, the mind and the brain are just the same thing, are identical with one another. And sometimes this theory gets especially called materialism, since the mind is being identified with something material, and so might call it the materialistic theory of the mind. So that's a sort of different extreme there. But there are also problems with that extreme, because for one thing, scientists haven't really explained to us how the mind could just be a brain or be reducible to a brain. It seems that there is more to the mind, or that in a certain sense, the mind is a different sort of thing altogether from the brain. And so in the philosophy of mind, it seems like the two views that might come most naturally, think about neither of which work very well. And it would be nice if there were some sort of middle ground or something that would help us get past the extreme of dualism, but also avoid the extreme of the identity theory. Well, it turns out that this kind of pattern of theories and problems appears not only in the philosophy of mind, here we've been talking about mind, but let me describe a similar pattern within ethics or moral philosophy. Because there are two similar positions that one might take, not that they're necessarily quite as attractive, but with respect to dualism, one could hold a view, although I'm offhand not sure if there are people who do hold this, that what is right and wrong, or good and bad, good and evil, these are what we would call moral characteristics, the kinds of things we talk about in ethics. Someone might hold a kind of dualist view about that right and wrong, good and bad, are totally independent of how things are in the actual world, and that perhaps good and bad, right and wrong, could vary independently of how things happen in the physical world, just as Descartes seems to have thought that the soul could operate on its own independently of how things are in the physical world. So perhaps there conceivably could be a kind of dualism about the nature of ethics also. If you're familiar with the divine command theory of ethics, where what makes something right or wrong is God's saying so, or God's approving of it, then conceivably the divine command theory could be a sort of dualistic approach to ethics, where right and wrong vary independently of the facts in the world, so to speak. Also, some people have thought that perhaps G.E. Moore's non-naturalism in Principia Ethica had this characteristic. I don't think it does, but some interpreters have looked at it that way. But again, I think this is quite an implausible view, and if I hadn't mentioned it just now in this context, there aren't very many people that would have jumped up and said, why did you forget about that? Because it just seems so implausible. But the opposite extreme is kind of implausible too. Some people have suggested that what we can do is try to define ethical terms in purely naturalistic ways. And if we could do that, then that would make the moral identical with the natural. That would then seem to be a parallel position that one might take. So in ethics, it generally goes under the term of naturalism, would be the other extreme on this side. There have been some attempts to give naturalistic definitions of moral terms, but none of them seem to work. And I won't go into the difficulties, but they're not all that different from the kind of difficulties that a materialism and an identity theory run into. So in ethics, we get a similar kind of pattern of possibilities where the extremes don't seem attractive, and we wonder if there might be something in between that would operate better. These are the two main examples I want to use today, but really the pattern can be extended also in some ways that I'll say as we go along. So, if both extremes are problematic, then it seems as though we would be interested in finding some sort of middle ground. And the question is, well, what would that middle ground be here, or what would that middle ground be here? Well, I'm glad you asked that question, or anyway, I asked it. And philosophers trying to stake out some sort of middle ground in these debates have articulated a relationship that they call supervenience. So I'm going to put supervenience in the middle here. as trying to articulate some sort of middle ground between extremes that don't seem plausible on their own, trying to find some way to navigate in between them, some way such that mental or moral properties aren't totally independent of the physical or natural world, but that mental or moral properties are not therefore just identical with things in the physical or the natural world, that there be some sort of relationship of dependence short of identity. Some people have seen antecedents to this way of thinking in G.E. Moore, again, in Principia Ethica, and also a paper of his called On the Conception of Intrinsic Value. The name supervenience seems to have been first put in the literature by Richard Hare, who was a moral philosopher in Oxford from the middle of the last century. Early discussions of the possibility of supervenience in the realm of the mind came from Donald Davidson and Jagwon Kim. I was one of the first people, I think, to kind of see that there were parallel issues going here and try and look at the problem from a sort of larger perspective, not focusing just on the particular issues, but on the structure of the issues. And if you're familiar with this kind of issue, you might have run across the phrase token identity as another attempt to find some sort of middle ground. This sort of identity on this extreme here, some philosophers have called this type identity, that is to say, identity between types of properties. And so I think Donald Davidson was the first one to say, well, maybe what we're looking for is not so much identity of types, but identity of tokens. And that led him to some ways of thinking that have kind of been associated with supervenience. These are not the same thing, but they often operate in conjunction with one another. And once you start seeing the parallels as the issues play out between in the realm of the mind and the realm of ethics, you can probably think of other philosophical realms where the same kind of pattern of issues arises. For example, aesthetics. It seems as though something's being beautiful is not totally independent of the characteristics of that thing. But on the other hand, we'd have trouble sort of spelling out the characteristics in such a way that we could actually define beauty in terms of the characteristics of a work of art. So it seems as though we would want to find some kind of middle ground in aesthetics. I think similar issues can arise also in matters of semantics and modality and so forth. So the pattern I'm describing here is one that has a lot of application in philosophical issues, though the most commonly discussed applications have to do with ethics and philosophy of mind. I think the easiest way to take a sort of first swipe at characterizing supervenience is a phrase that Willard Van Orman Quine was famous for. Quine is an American logician and philosopher of language from the middle part of the 20th century. And Quine was famous for this slogan, No difference without a physical difference. And that slogan seems to help us avoid this over here, because this does seem to allow differences without physical differences, as though the mind or the ethics could just vary independently of the physical. But the slogan here doesn't seem to require identity or definition of the mental or the moral in other terms. So perhaps this is a kind of minimal requirement that helps us set out some middle ground. And more or less discussion of supervenience over the decades has been a matter of trying to figure out how to fill out this slogan in more precise terms. And so that's a topic that I've worked on quite a bit. And there is a lot that's been published about working that out, and if it interests you, we can talk about some of those complications. But what I wanted to do today was talk about one particular aspect of the problem having to do with supervenience through time, and this is what I'm calling diachronic supervenience, as opposed to synchronic supervenience, which would mean supervenience at a given time. So I'm interested in what the relationship is between supervenience as it might hold at a given point in time, and on the other hand, supervenience as it might hold through time. So this is where the terms synchronic and diachronic come in. So with that introduction then, let me go to my script here and I'll be a little more formal, but I'm happy to stop along the way either to elaborate, or if you have a question along the way that really is urgent in understanding something, please feel free to interrupt me. Or we can also have discussion at the end. So I want to pick up on an issue that was mentioned of long time ago. Now, I guess this was 1971. It didn't seem so long ago when I first started thinking about this issue, but now it's, 40 years ago. Anyway, there's a paper by Simon Blackburn. Simon is an English British philosopher who has also taught in the United States, a paper called Moral Realism, in which Simon set out and distinguished between supervenience as it holds between kinds of properties at a given time, on the one hand, and supervenience as it holds between kinds of properties over time. And so this is on your handout. And S2 is at least his initial characterization of supervenience as it holds between properties at a given time. So we're calling this synchronic supervenience. I put in parentheses weak because as we progress, as you see further down in the paper, I'm going to contrast this with something that I came to call strong supervenience also. So there are some differences there, but for our purposes right now, we don't need to worry about them. Anyway, synchronic supervenience, as called S2 here, is as follows. A property M, so this could mean a property like pain, you know, being in pain, or it could mean a property like being morally good. He says a property M is supervenient upon properties N1 through NN. Now by the N properties he's talking about here, well, if this is a mental property, then we'd be talking about the various physical properties of the brain. So this is M, and these are the N's here. And if this is the M here, then this would be various natural properties. So the N, if it's pain that we're concerned with, then the natural properties would be a description of your brain, or the description of the person who's in pain, that person's brain at the given time. And you know, philosophers don't generally know a whole lot of neuroscience, so I hope I can just kind of talk through this and nobody's going to have big objections. But you know, we talk sometimes about the firing of C fibers or the firing of delta fibers. Those are two kinds of cells in the brain, and they have at least been associated with the experience of pain. And so the idea with regard to synchronic supervenience here is if your brain and my brain are in exactly the same state so far as the firing of C fibers goes, then it'll be in the same state so far as our experience of pain goes. We'll both be experiencing pain if our brains are both in the same state. It couldn't be the case that our brains are in exactly the same state, but I'm experiencing pain and you're not. That's what is excluded by supervenience. So Simon's way of putting it is that a property M is supervenient upon properties N, 1 through NN if it is logically impossible that two things should each possess the same properties, N, to the same degree without both failing to possess or both possessing M to the same degree. In other words, you and I can't differ mentally if we don't differ physically. And similarly, with regard to ethics, two situations that we might encounter in the world, if they're exactly the same as one another, we couldn't say that one is bad and the other is good, because moral properties are supervenient. And thus, if I say that this is bad and this is good, there must be some other difference between them that, as we might say, accounts for that difference. They couldn't differ only in purely moral ways. Okay, so diachronic supervenience then is what he calls S here, holds between kinds of properties over time. So he says a property M is supervenient upon properties N1 through NN if it's logically impossible that a thing should become N or cease to be M or become more or less M than before without changing in respect of some member N1 through NN. So if over a period of 5 minutes my brain does not change in any respect whatsoever, I can't start feeling pain or stop feeling pain or feel more or less pain over that period of time unless there's some other change that goes on at the level of the brain. So this is supervenience through time as opposed to supervenience at a time. And Blackburn thinks that the two of those really do go together, even though we can articulate two different concepts here. Blackburn thought that really they're connected with one another. Blackburn went on to remark in the original article, he said, it is difficult to think of a property that might be supervenient upon some others in the sense of S diachronically, but not supervenient upon these others in the sense of S2 synchronically. And Blackburn said, I can think of no argument that might be used to show that moral properties are supervenient upon naturalistic ones in one sense, but not the other. So Blackburn's initial claim about this is that even though we can explain the difference between synchronic and diachronic supervenience, still, they're always going to go together. If something is synchronically supervenient, it will be diachronically too. And that makes a lot of sense. And I want to grant him his claim at least in one direction, namely that diachronic supervenience implies synchronic supervenience. Let me put this on the board. So insofar as we can distinguish between supervenience as called diachronic and synchronic, Blackburn seems to think that they go together, so to speak, that if you have this, you have that, and vice versa. And for the sake of the paper here, I'm just going to grant him this direction here. What I want to do in the paper is look at the question whether the relation holds in that direction. And that's what I'm going to look at. So if you're familiar with basic logic and you're trying to test a conditional to see whether a conditional holds, see if A then B, see if that holds, what you want to do is imagine that A is true and see if you can find a situation in which B is false. That's the row on the truth table that gives you a false for the conditional. So basically what I'm interested in doing is finding out if we can find a situation where synchronic supervenience holds but diachronic supervenience fails. And if we did, then that would be that would falsify that conditional. Although Blackburn's original paper where he discussed this was concerned especially with moral properties, he did write a later version of his thoughts in which he extended his discussion to mental properties as well. And for the purpose of this paper, then, I'll be considering really any of a variety of kinds of realms in which supervenience might be at stake. So the question is, can we find any examples to show that properties are supervenient in one sense but not in the other? And in particular, I'm going to look at whether we can find cases of properties that are supervenient synchronically but not diachronically. And it was for the purpose of this test that I came up with three examples to think about. And so these are on your handout also. So I said, consider the following three cases. And I just called them A, B, and C. And they have to do with abortion. And in the United States, abortion is a morally controversial issue. I don't know if it is in Norway. If it's not, then you might want to pick out some issue that is morally controversial in Norway. But we'll just stick with abortion. It doesn't really matter whether it's controversial, although it makes it more interesting. So here are the three scenarios I want to think about. Scenario A. On Monday, I judge that a case of abortion is morally wrong, and another case of abortion, just like it, is morally acceptable. Scenario B. On Monday, I judge that a case of abortion is morally wrong, and on Tuesday, I judge that it, or a case just like it, is morally acceptable. And C. On Monday, I judge that a case of abortion on Monday is morally wrong, and a case just like it, except that it occurs on Tuesday, is morally acceptable. Okay, so I hope you can see the difference. I mean, the differences are somewhat subtle, but there are differences between these three scenarios, and there are differences that I think will help bring out some of the issues I want to talk about. Case A, so this is, on Monday I judge that a case of abortion is morally wrong, and another case of abortion just like it is morally acceptable. How many think that's problematic? Okay, I think it's problematic, yeah. Case A seems unacceptable because, well, precisely because it violates synchronic supervenience. Okay, it doesn't seem as though these two cases could differ in their rightness or wrongness if they're just the same as one another. What about case C? Okay, case C. On Monday, I judge that a case of abortion on Monday is morally wrong, and a case just like it, except that it occurs on Tuesday, is morally acceptable. So here, C is just a little bit different from A. The difference is that there is a difference between the two cases I'm judging, although the difference is simply one of location and time. How many still think that this is a fishy case and there's something problematic about this? Okay. Case C seems unacceptable because it violates diachronic supervenience. Okay. Because one of the things about diachronic supervenience says that if something stays the same in all of its characteristics through time, all of its non-moral characteristics through time, it's got to stay the same in its moral characteristics through time, too. So it seems as though case A is a clear, straightforward violation of synchronic supervenience, and case C is a straightforward violation of diachronic supervenience. And if any of you are economists, one of the things that C does is violate what we call, is to express what we call pure time preference, which is weird. I mean, pure time preference is where something might be preferable to something else merely because it's a location in time. I think economists think that that's kind of problematic, and so do philosophers. But what about case B? This is the one that I want to focus our attention on. Now, B is no different from case C, except that the judgments take place at different times. Okay, so let's look at case B. On Monday, I judge that a case of abortion is morally wrong, and on Tuesday, I judge that it, or a case just like it, is morally acceptable. What do you think about that? Is that problematic, or can you think of some scenario in which that might be acceptable?
Well, I think it's quite acceptable, because if you consistently, in retrospect, alter your judgment about the case on Monday.
Okay, good.
So you could change, because in ethics, what supervenience can prove, except if you are a naturalist, is just the fact that an action with exactly the same factual properties must have the same value, but which value it has is not implied by that.
Right. Okay.
So if you change the value, then
you have to go back and make other adjustments too.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it would be problematic if, you know, you judge that it's wrong on Monday, on Tuesday you judge that it's okay, but you could still keep thinking that it was wrong before, even though there's no change. But you're right, if on Tuesday you judge that it's okay, and then in retrospect you say, and I was wrong before, and you'd change your judgment about that case, that seems plausible. And I guess we would describe it by saying that you changed your mind, basically. We don't have objections per se to changing your mind. I mean, we'll hope that it's for good reasons and so forth. We'll hope it's not arbitrary. But if what's going on in scenario B is a case of changing your mind, that makes sense. But if you do change your mind, you have to change your mind about all the cases. You can't keep these separate. Okay, so good. Now, one might object to my inconsistent judgments, but this may be an appropriate occasion to invoke Emerson's slogan, and here this is sort of connected with changing your mind. Ralph Waldo Emerson is famous for the slogan, "Foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." Sometimes quoted as, "Consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, but I wouldn't want to endorse that. I mean, I think there's a lot going for consistency, but foolish consistency. What do we mean by foolish consistency? Well, you know, especially liberals like myself in the United States think that George Bush, George W. Bush, foolishly insisted on pursuing the war in Iraq. You know, mostly for the sake of consistency. He had set out on that course, so he was not about to change that course. You know, we might call that foolish consistency if things had changed in the meantime. And Creon in Antigone's place, Sophocles, if you think of Creon, the ruler, it seemed as though maybe he should have changed his judgment about whether whoever buries Polynices should be executed. But even when he finds out it's Polynices' sister, his own daughter, own niece, he insists on sticking to the same situation. So anyway, one oughtn't to stick with the same judgment over time just for the sake of sticking to the same judgment. It can make sense to change your judgment, although if you do so, you then have to retrospectively change the other. So that's the point we're making here. So diachronic supervenience does not preclude looking back on an earlier judgment that you made and deciding that it was wrong to make that judgment. But if I do change my mind, I have to change my mind about the past case as well. Okay. But we do seem to have a case in situation B where an action has ceased to be M. So we judged that the situation, we had judged that it was wrong. Now we judge that it's not wrong. So it has ceased to be M, but it hasn't changed in any of its naturalistic characteristics. Okay, I said it was a case exactly like. So it seems as though if I change my mind and judge differently, I still have a case here of violating diachronic supervenience because it seems as though, because it's a situation where the case remained the same through time, but the moral characteristic, at least my judgment of the moral characteristic, did change over time. Now one might object that my endorsement or my judgment that it's right and then later that it's wrong should itself count as a member of N. You might say, well, look, something naturalistic has changed between yesterday and today, namely my statement about this or my take on this. But that seems to me to be a stretch because these naturalistic properties here were meant not to be sort of external facts about the situation, but the characteristics of the situation itself. And my reaction to the situation is not one of the characteristics of the action itself. It's external, you might say. My holding a principle about the action could hardly be construed as a property of the action being judged. And the scenario is supposed to be one in which the properties of the action being judged stay the same. Another way to make this point is to imagine a possible world fully or at least relevantly described by and by the N properties here, which I judge to be, say, unjust. I might later judge this world, or one exactly or relevantly like it, to be unjust, I mean, to be just. So we're imagining two possible worlds that are the same in all respects. I judge of one world that it's unjust, and I judge of the other world that it's just. Now, in that case, I haven't made any changes in the nature of the possible worlds themselves. So again, I think we have an example, at least at one level, of a violation of diachronic supervenience, where the world stays the same, but the judgment about the world changes over time. Now, this case, however, does bring out a problem that's not always been noticed. And this was one of the things that in my early research on these issues 20 years or so ago, it was important to me to bring out because I thought people were missing it, that the cases we've been considering have clearly treated moral properties here as projected by a judge. You know, my saying that abortion was wrong and then changing my mind to think that abortion is right, or my saying that this possible world is unjust and this possible world is just. So what we've been talking about here is sort of judgments about or projections by a judge as opposed to what you might have thought we were talking about, whether the action has this property or not, or whether this possible world has the property of being just. So there's these two ways of thinking about the way the ethics enters in, a kind of, you might say, realist way or metaphysical way in which the action has a certain moral property, and the more, you might say, projectivist or, as I call it, ascriptivist way of talking about whether the situation is judged to be right or wrong. So there's these two pretty different ways of thinking about how the ethics comes in, whether it's sort of there as itself a property, or whether it's there only as a projection, you know, from the judge, from me making a judgment about that. What we're talking about is what the judge has to say about the situation, this is what I've called ascriptive supervenience. And when we're talking about what characteristic the situation has, I've called that ontological supervenience. So suppose we focus instead for the moment on what I'm calling ontological supervenience. So let's leave out the idea of me changing my mind or me judging from the outside and just look at what it might take for a situation to be wrong or to be just or unjust. And this would involve being realists about the supervening property, you know, to think that the supervening property is a real thing, you know, real in the situation. Could supervening facts change over time without a change in the subvening facts? So if the situation stayed the same over time, could the fact of its being right change over that time? And from this point of view, I think that the cases that come most readily to mind are cases of what we would call conceptual change. So here now, having talked some about judgments and so forth, now I want to look at another angle on the problem of whether there could be conceptual change through time, and whether conceptual change through time might allow for a change in the supervening characteristics without any change in the subvening characteristics. So consider the medical condition of consumption. If any of you have read novels by Dickens or Dostoevsky, you know that there's usually a couple of female characters who cough a lot and are thin and poor, and they eventually die. And what they died of is consumption, right? In Crime and Punishment, Sonia's stepmother, Katerina Ivanovna Marmeladov, has consumption. And in fact, I read in 1815, 1 in 4 deaths in England was due to consumption. Now, no one dies of consumption. Not because, like smallpox, we've come up with a vaccine to wipe out consumption, but rather because there is no longer any such disease as consumption. If a molecule-by-molecule replica of Katerina Ivanovna were to appear now, she would not have consumption, but most likely she'd have, I don't know, tuberculosis or something like that. If Katerina Ivanovna's consumption were not rapid, and she managed to live with it through the changes in medicine of the early 20th century, it might be said that she had ceased to have consumption. She would have ceased to have the M property, whatever the supervening property is, without changing in respect to some member of her naturalistic characteristics. Her body could remain the same in all respects, but she no longer has consumption. Not because we cured it, but because there is no longer such a disease. One may be tempted to try to assimilate this example to the case of ascriptive supervenience I discussed earlier. Rather than saying that Katerina had consumption, maybe what we should say is that she was said to have consumption, and then later was no longer said to have consumption. So the kind of case I just described about our conceptual evolution of the concept of consumption might lead you to think, well, really, that's a kind of ascriptive case too. And she never really had consumption. She was just said to have consumption. And then later, when that disease was no longer in our repertoire, she would no longer be said to have consumption. There was never a fact of Katerina Ivanovna having consumption because consumption was shown to have been a defective concept, conflating as it did various conditions which we would now call don't know, tuberculosis, lung cancer, pleurisy, and so forth. This is a possible position to take, especially given our modern rejection of consumption as a useful concept, but it's hard to divide concepts up confidently between those we can afford to take an ascriptive view of and those that we honor as factual or ontological. For example, according to the World Health Organization, every year now 1.3 million people die of cancer. Yet those who study cancer know that, like consumption, it may turn out to conflate a variety of conditions that researchers will eventually find to be worth distinguishing. So 50 years from now, there may be no such condition as cancer. So the diagnosis we use for consumption, or I should say, you know, the sort of philosophical account we gave of consumption a minute ago, really might well turn out to be the philosophical account we're going to give of cancer in a while. And the problem here is that it's hard to know what it would take to be confident of a concept in a way that would insulate it from these kind of considerations. If the assimilation of ascriptive supervenience is to be complete, however, we must not only say that Katerina Ivanovna no longer has consumption, but along the line of what you were just saying, we'd have to, in retrospect, say, and she didn't even have consumption back then, you know, to be consistent in our application of the terms. And not only that people no longer die from consumption, but that they never did die from consumption. And so the report that 1 in 4 people in Britain in the 18th century died of consumption, that would be false, actually, from our modern point of view. And that seems harder to accept. It holds the truth of all such claims hostage to the future march of science. Not so much the discoveries of science, but the conceptual impact of science on our conceptual scheme. On the other hand, my judgment that this case of abortion today is morally acceptable entails that the same or relevantly similar case yesterday wasn't morally wrong after all. That was the point we were reminded of before, despite my condemnation of it at the time. And we similarly would feel comfortable, don't we, with an analogous treatment of the concept of a witch. I mean, insofar as we don't accept the concept of witch anymore, then we have to look back at least in the United States, at the Salem witch trials and say those women weren't witches from our perspective. They're not witches and they never were. So the fate of diachronic ontological supervenience seems to hang on our treatment of the cases of conceptual evolution, where we come to not so much reject as to refine a concept over time. And under such circumstances, it seems fair to say that something that was M has ceased to be M without changing in respect of some member N1 through NN. So what we seem to have is a contingency in the relationship between N-type properties and M-type properties, not just at a time, but over time. So conceptual change, to me at least, opens up the possibility of violations of diachronic supervenience. Well, how might a concept evolve in this way? So here I want to throw out a sort of scenario for you to react to, see what you think. I came up with it from watching television, and so it's kind of a wacky example, but well, let's start with something that everyone would agree is a sport. In baseball, in the United States, I would use baseball, but in this country, maybe football. Would that be something that everyone would agree is a sport? Okay, now I'm going to call this Q. So everyone agrees that that is a sport. Now I'm going to come up with something else that's at least initially, and we'll call it Z, that isn't a sport. Or at least I wouldn't have thought it was a sport. Rock, paper, scissors. I don't know if that's something that you're familiar with in Norway, but if we're trying to compete, you know, about something, decide who's right, you might flip a coin, you might draw straws, you say, or we might do rock, paper, scissors. So this is where you go to, there's the scissors, there's the rock, and there's the paper, okay? And paper beats rock because it wraps it up. Rock beats scissors because it smashes it, and scissors beat paper because they cuts it, right? Everyone familiar with that? Okay, that's a game, or at least we played it as a game in childhood. But at least in the United States on ESPN, I don't know, did you get ESPN here? In the United States, they actually have rock, paper, scissors televised. That's what I saw on TV. So the question is rock, paper, scissors a sport? And as much as I've told you right now, the answer is no. But I wonder if it would matter how many intermediate cases we might come up with. Because as I just present them to start with, these are clearly two different kinds of things. But if I can present you with enough intermediate cases, I wonder if it might turn out to be the case that these are both the same kind of thing with respect to that. And what started us down the slippery slope is the presence of poker on ESPN. Okay, how many of you have seen poker played on TV? Okay, I never would have said poker was a sport either, but it's a game too. But so we'll call this P, poker. Is it a sport? Well, I don't know, but the question is, if we can fill in enough cases, gradually building out from the cases that clearly are sport, and coming close enough to the case that at least to start with, clearly was not a sport, I wonder if we end up in a situation where this is a sport after all. Okay, this is what I'm proposing as a sort of thought experiment about the concept of sport, and in particular about the evolution of the concept of sport. And I'm wondering if it could evolve in such a way that something which originally was not a sport comes to be a sport without anything about it changing. And if that's true, that would be a violation of diachronic supervenience. Or at least I'm throwing that out for consideration. So let me talk kind of quickly through this because I know my time is about up and I haven't really finished what I want to talk about. But actually, I think I've probably said enough about what I'm imagining there. Now, what makes rock, paper, scissors a sport now is that poker is apparently a sport. And what made poker a sport was, well, I don't know, but the question is whether it's thought to be the kind of thing worth televising on ESPN. And if you take the, definition of sport to be the kind of thing worth televising on ESPN, if they first started this and then eventually got over there, then the concept has evolved over time in that way. Now, perhaps these problems just arise from context, and you might say that the existence of the continuum, I'll call this a continuum of cases, you might say the existence of the continuum is relevant here. So, and you might say, you know, so Z has changed over time, it's changed because of these adjacent sort of cases here. Whereas I want to say, no, we can see the adjacent cases as external to this. This has remained the same through time, even though we've put it in some different kind of context. And you might want to debate this by saying, well, look, the context really has to be considered part of this. So one of the issues I think at stake here is whether there's a sense in which we can understand a situation apart from its context. And you know, using possible worlds terminology, we could say, you know, is a possible world in which rock, paper, scissors is played a sport or not? And then we could say, well, I, judging from the outside, aware of these intermediate cases, may judge it to be a sport eventually or not. But none of that has to do with the nature of rock, paper, scissors itself. And so you can see how the changing circumstances might also be construed as a change in the ascription of the characteristic. Because if the changing circumstances are assimilated to their effect on me making a judgment about this, then they're treated as an ascriptive sort of case. Or on the other hand, you could say the circumstances have their relevance mostly as changing the nature of the situation itself, in which case you're trying to treat it as an ontological case of supervenience. So let me go down to the bottom example, since I really am running short of time, strong synchronic supervenience. I've just one more kind of argument that someone might give that synchronic supervenience really does guarantee diachronic supervenience. And so if you look at the bottom example, strong synchronic supervenience, it stands in contrast to the top example. If you're familiar with possible worlds terminology, weak synchronic supervenience is a relationship that holds within a given possible world. We're saying, in a given world, if two situations are exactly alike in its naturalistic respects, then they must be like in their supervening respects. What strong supervenience does is free us from that limitation and allow us to talk about situations that are in different possible worlds. So that if a situation in this possible world is exactly the same as the situation in this possible world, strong supervenience says still they have to have the same supervening characteristic. So that's the difference between weak and strong. And the reason strong might be useful here is that we could conceivably interpret the passage of time as itself an index of possible worlds. So we could say that, you know, the world on Monday and the world on Tuesday, if you go back to the abortion case I described earlier, you could just say, well, those are just two different possible worlds. So each, you know, passage of time constitutes a new possible world. And so if you're allowed to do it that way, then strong synchronic supervenience seems to encompass diachronic supervenience by treating worlds through time as themselves just one more world, and treating them all the same. And so the formulation at the bottom there basically says, for all supervening properties and all subvening properties, the pound sign there means complete naturalist description. It's not just focusing on a single property, but a complete naturalist description of something. And then X ranges over property objects, and W ranges over possible worlds. And so it's saying, for all of these, if an object is in a certain possible world W, and it has a complete naturalistic description N, and it has some supervening characteristic, then any other object in any other world that has that same naturalistic description also will have that same supervening property. So the formulation at the bottom, it looks complicated, but doesn't really say anything complicated. But if we allow the possible worlds ranging in W to range over temporal worlds as well, then that would seem to include diachronic supervenience within synchronic supervenience. But, and here's the point I want to make, this kind of formulation doesn't fully capture the problem I'm describing. In particular, case B cannot be described by the formula at the bottom there, because the interesting thing about case B is that it takes into account the position of the person making the judgment. And there's no way, using possible worlds terminology, to take that fact into account in the formulation. So I don't have time to beat that to death, but it's a point that I'll defend if people want to talk about that some more. So, what I've done is not, I haven't proven that there's an exception to this principle here from synchronic to diachronic supervenience. What I've done is raise the kind of problems that I think are at stake in thinking about diachronic supervenience, and they have to do with a scriptive conception of supervenience, and they have to do with the possibility of conceptual change and how you interpret conceptual change. And the conclusion I want to draw from this is that it's possible to defend this implication from synchronic to diachronic, but only by either insisting that all kind of cases of synchronic supervenience, diachronic supervenience, really involve the circumstances as part of the situation itself, or they insist that the situation be judged from an ascriptive point of view. And I think both of those defenses, while they can be mounted, are what they do is kind of undermine the idea that synchronic supervenience can be an ontological state of affairs. They kind of undermine the realistic or the ontological heft of synchronic supervenience. So that's the set of issues I want us to think about, and those are the complications that I'm interested in. Thank you.